She bit her lip and said, "Then shall I send Valentine to you?" The old man closed his eyes eagerly, thereby intimating that such was his wish. Monsieur and Madame de Villefort bowed and left the room, giving orders that Valentine should be summoned to her grandfather's presence, and feeling sure that she would have much to do to restore calmness to the perturbed spirit of the invalid. Valentine, with the colour still heightened by emotion, entered the room just after her parents had quitted it. One look was sufficient to tell her that her grandfather was suffering and that there was much on his mind which he was wishing to communicate to her. "Dear Grandpapa," cried she, "what has happened? They have vexed you, and you are angry." The paralytic closed his eyes in token of assent. "Who has displeased you? Is it my father?" "No." "Madame de Villefort?" "No." "Me?" The former sign was repeated. "Are you displeased with me?" cried Valentine in astonishment. Monsieur Noirtier again closed his eyes. "And what have I done, dear Grandpapa, that you should be angry with me?" cried Valentine. There was no answer, and she continued, "I have not seen you all day. Has anyone been speaking to you against me?" "Yes," said the old man's look with eagerness. "Let me think a moment. I do assure you, Grandpapa—" "Ah! Monsieur and Madame de Villefort have just left this room, have they not?" "Yes." "And it was they who told you something which made you angry? What was it, then? May I go and ask them, that I may have the opportunity of making my peace with you?"
"No, no," said Noirtier's look.
"Ah, you frighten me. What can they have said?"
And she again tried to think what it could be.
"Ah, I know," said she,
lowering her voice and going close to the old man.
"They have been speaking of my marriage, have they not?"
"Yes," replied the angry look.
"I understand. You are displeased at the silence I have preserved on the subject. The reason of it was that they had insisted on my keeping the matter a secret, and begged me not to tell you anything of it. They did not even acquaint me with their intentions, and I only discovered them by chance. That is why I have been so reserved with you, dear Grandpapa. Pray forgive me."
But there was no look calculated to reassure her. All it seemed to say was, "It is not only your reserve which afflicts me."
"What is it, then?" asked the young girl. "Perhaps you think I shall abandon you, dear Grandpapa, and that I shall forget you when I am married."
"No."
"They told you, then, that Monsieur d'Epernay consented to our all living together?"
"Yes."
"Then why are you still vexed and grieved?"
The old man's eyes beamed with an expression of gentle affection.
"Yes, I understand," said Valentine. "It is because you love me."
The old man assented.
"And you are afraid I shall be unhappy?"
"Yes."
"You do not like Monsieur France?"
The eyes repeated several times, "No, no, no."
"Then you are vexed at the engagement?"
"Yes."
"Well, listen," said Valentine,
throwing herself on her knees and putting her arm round her grandfather's neck.
"I am vexed too, for I do not love Monsieur France d'Epernay."
An expression of intense joy illumined the old man's eyes.
"When I wished to retire into a convent, you remember how angry you were with me?"
A tear trembled in the eye of the invalid.
"Well," continued Valentine, "the reason of my proposing it was that I might escape this hateful marriage which drives me to despair."
Noirtier's breathing became thick and short.
"Then the idea of this marriage really grieves you, too? Ah, if you could but help me, if we could both together defeat their plan. But you are unable to oppose them. You, whose mind is so quick and whose will is so firm, are, nevertheless, as weak and unequal to the contest as I am myself. Alas, you, who would have been such a powerful protector to me in the days of your health and strength, can now only sympathize in my joys and sorrows, without being able to take any active part in them. However, this is much and calls for gratitude, and heaven has not taken away all my blessings when it leaves me your sympathy and kindness."
At these words, there appeared in Noirtier's eyes an expression of such deep meaning that the young girl thought she could read these words there.
"You are mistaken. I can still do much for you." "Do you think you can help me, dear Grandpapa?" said Valentine.
"Yes." Noirtier raised his eyes. It was the sign agreed on between him and Valentine when he wanted anything.
"What is it you want, dear Grandpapa?" said Valentine,
and she endeavoured to recall to mind all the things which he would be likely to need, and as the ideas presented themselves to her mind, she repeated them aloud. But finding that all her efforts elicited nothing but a constant "no,"
"Come," said she, "since this plan does not answer, I will have recourse to another."
She then recited all the letters of the alphabet, from A down to N. When she arrived at that letter, the paralytic made her understand that was the initial letter of the thing which he wanted.
"Ah," said Valentine, "the thing you desire begins with the letter N. It is with N that we have to do, then. Well, let me see. What can you want that begins with N?
Na? Ne? Ni? No?
Yes. Yes, yes," said the old man's eyes.
"Ah, it is no, then."
"Yes."
Valentine fetched a dictionary, which she placed on a desk before Noirtier. She opened it, and seeing that the old man's eye was thoroughly fixed on its pages, she ran her finger quickly up and down the columns. During the 6 years which had passed since Noirtier first fell into this sad state, Valentine's powers of invention had been too often put to the test not to render her expert in devising expedients for gaining a knowledge of his wishes, and the constant practice had so perfected her in the art that she guessed the old man's meaning as quickly as if he himself had been able to seek for what he wanted. At the word notary, Noirtier made a sign to her to stop.
"Notary," said she. "Do you want a notary, dear Grandpapa?"
The old man again signified that it was a notary he desired.
"You would wish a notary to be sent for, then," said Valentine.
"Yes."
"Shall my father be informed of your wish?"
"Yes."
"Do you wish the notary should be sent for immediately?"
"Yes."
"Then they shall go for him directly, dear Grandpapa. Is that all you want?"
"Yes." Valentine rang the bell and ordered the servant to tell Monsieur and Madame de Villefort that they were requested to come to Monsieur Noirtier's room.
"Are you satisfied now?" inquired Valentine.
"Yes."
"I am sure you are. It is not very difficult to discover that."
And the young girl smiled on her grandfather as if he had been a child. Monsieur de Villefort entered, followed by Barrois.
"What do you want me for, sir?" demanded he of the paralytic.
"Sir," said Valentine, "my grandfather wishes for a notary."
At this strange and unexpected demand, Monsieur de Villefort and his father exchanged looks.
"Yes," motioned the latter, with a firmness which seemed to declare that with the help of Valentine and his old servant, who both knew what his wishes were, he was quite prepared to maintain the contest.
"Do you wish for a notary?" asked Villefort.
"Yes."
"What to do?"
Noirtier made no answer.
"What do you want with a notary?" again repeated Villefort.
The invalid's eye remained fixed, by which expression he intended to intimate that his resolution was unalterable.
"Is it to do us some ill turn? Do you think it is worth while?" said Villefort.
"Still," said Barrois, with the freedom and fidelity of an old servant, "if Monsieur Noirtier asks for a notary, I suppose he really wishes for a notary. Therefore, I shall go at once and fetch one."
Barrois acknowledged no master but Noirtier, and never allowed his desires in any way to be contradicted.
"Yes, I do want a notary," motioned the old man, shutting his eyes with a look of defiance which seemed to say, "And I should like to see the person who dares to refuse my request."
"You shall have a notary, as you absolutely wish for one, sir," said Villefort. "But I shall explain to him your state of health and make excuses for you, for the scene cannot fail of being a most ridiculous one."
"Never mind that," said Barrois. "I shall go and fetch a notary nevertheless."
And the old servant departed triumphantly on his mission.
This book is continued on Disc 3.
The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas.
Disc 3.
60. The Will. As soon as Barrois had left the room, Noirtier looked at Valentine with that peculiar expression which conveyed so much deep meaning. The young girl perfectly understood the look, and so did Villefort, for his countenance became clouded, and he knitted his eyebrows angrily. He took a seat and quietly awaited the arrival of the notary. Noirtier saw him seat himself with an appearance of perfect indifference, at the same time giving a side look at Valentine, which made her understand that she also was to remain in the room. 3/4 of an hour after, Barrois returned, bringing the notary with him.
"Sir," said Villefort, after the first salutations were over, "you were sent for by Monsieur Noirtier, whom you see here. All his limbs have become completely paralyzed. He has lost his voice also, and we ourselves find much trouble in endeavoring to catch some fragments of his meaning."
Noirtier cast an appealing look on Valentine, which look was at once so earnest and imperative that she answered immediately.
"Sir," said she, "I perfectly understand my grandfather's meaning at all times."
"That is quite true," said Barrois, "and that is what I told the gentleman as we walked along."
"Permit me," said the notary, turning first to Villefort and then to Valentine, "permit me to state that the case in question is just one of those in which a public officer like myself cannot proceed to act without thereby incurring a dangerous responsibility. The first thing necessary to render an act valid is that the notary should be thoroughly convinced that he has faithfully interpreted the will and wishes of the person dictating the act. Now, I cannot be sure of the approbation or disapprobation of a client who cannot speak, and as the object of his desire or his repugnance cannot be clearly proved to me on account of his want of speech, my services here would be quite useless and cannot be legally exercised."
The notary then prepared to retire. An imperceptible smile of triumph was expressed on the lips of the Procureur du Roi. Noirtier looked at Valentine with an expression so full of grief that she arrested the departure of the notary.
"Sir," said she, "the language which I speak with my grandfather may be easily learnt, and I can teach you in a few minutes to understand it almost as well as I can myself. Will you tell me what you require in order to set your conscience quite at ease on the subject?"
"In order to render an act valid, I must be certain of the approbation or disapprobation of my client. Illness of the body would not affect the validity of the deed, but sanity of mind is absolutely requisite."
"Well, sir, by the help of 2 signs, with which I will acquaint you presently, you may ascertain with perfect certainty that my grandfather is still in the full possession of all his mental faculties. Monsieur Noirtier, being deprived of voice and motion, is accustomed to convey his meaning by closing his eyes when he wishes to signify yes, and to wink when he means no. You now know quite enough to enable you to converse with Monsieur Noirtier. Try."
Noirtier gave Valentine such a look of tenderness and gratitude that it was comprehended even by the notary himself.
"You have heard and understood what your granddaughter has been saying, sir, have you?" asked the notary.
Noirtier closed his eyes.
"And you approve of what she said? That is to say, you declare that the signs which she mentioned are really those by means of which you are accustomed to convey your thoughts?"
"Yes."
"It was you who sent for me?"
"Yes."
"To make your will?"
"Yes."
"And you do not wish me to go away without fulfilling your original intentions?"
The old man winked violently.
"Well, sir," said the young girl, "do you understand now, and is your conscience perfectly at rest on the subject?"
But before the notary could answer, Villefort had drawn him aside.
"Sir," said he, "do you suppose for a moment that a man can sustain a physical shock such as Monsieur Noirtier has received without any detriment to his mental faculties?"
"It is not exactly that, sir,"
said the notary, which makes me uneasy, but the difficulty will be in arriving at his thoughts and intentions so as to be able to provoke his answers.
You must see that to be an utter impossibility, said Vifor.
Valentine and the old man heard this conversation, and Noirtier fixed his eye so earnestly on Valentine that she felt bound to answer to the look.
Sir, said she, that need not make you uneasy, however difficult it may at first sight appear to be. I can discover and explain to you my grandfather's thoughts, so as to put an end to all your doubts and fears on the subject. I have now been 6 years with Monsieur Noirtier, and let him tell you if ever once during that time he has entertained a thought which he was unable to make me understand.
No, sighed the old man.
Let us try what we can do, then, said the notary. You accept this young lady as your interpreter, Monsieur Noirtier?
Yes.
Well, sir, what do you require of me, and what document is it that you wish to be drawn up?
Valentine named all the letters of the alphabet till she came to W. At this letter, the eloquent eye of Noirtier gave her notice that she was to stop.
It is very evident that it is the letter W which Monsieur Noirtier wants, said the notary.
Wait, said Valentine, and turning to her grandfather, she repeated, Wah, weh, weh. The old man stopped her at the last syllable. Valentine then took the dictionary, and the notary watched her whilst she turned over the pages. She passed her finger slowly down the columns, and when she came to the word will, Monsieur Noirtier's eye bade her stop.
Will, cried the notary. It is very evident that Monsieur Noirtier is desirous of making his will.
Yes, 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 motioned the invalid.
Really, sir, you must allow that this is most extraordinary, said the astonished notary, turning to Monsieur de Vifor.
Yes, said the procureur, and I think the will promises to be yet more extraordinary, for I cannot see how it is to be drawn up without the intervention of Valentine, and she may perhaps be considered as too much interested in its contents to allow of her being a suitable interpreter of the obscure and ill-defined wishes of her grandfather.
No, 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 replied the eye of the paralytic.
What? Said Vifor. Do you mean to say that Valentine is not interested in your will?
No.
Sir,
said the notary, whose interest had been greatly excited, and who had resolved on publishing far and wide the account of this extraordinary and picturesque scene.
What appeared so impossible to me an hour ago has now become quite easy and practicable. And this may be a perfectly valid will, provided it be read in the presence of 7 witnesses, approved by the testator, and sealed by the notary in the presence of the witnesses. As to the time, it will certainly occupy rather more than the generality of wills. There are certain forms necessary to be gone through, and which are always the same. As to the details, the greater part will be furnished afterwards by the state in which we find the affairs of the testator, and by yourself, who, having had the management of them, can, doubtless, give full information on the subject. But, besides all this, in order that the instrument may not be contested, I am anxious to give it the greatest possible authenticity. Therefore, one of my colleagues will help me, and, contrary to custom, will assist in the dictation of the testament.
Are you satisfied, sir? Continued the notary, addressing the old man.
Yes, looked the invalid, his eye beaming with delight at his meaning being so well understood. What is he going to do? Thought Vifor, whose position demanded so much reserve, but who was longing to know what were the intentions of his father.
He left the room to give orders for another notary to be sent, but Barois, who had heard all that passed, had guessed his master's wishes and had already gone to fetch one. The procureur du roi then told his wife to come up. In the course of a quarter of an hour, everyone had assembled in the chamber of the paralytic. The second notary had also arrived. A few words sufficed for a mutual understanding between the two officers of the law. They read to Noirtier the formal copy of a will in order to give him an idea of the terms in which such documents are generally couched. Then, in order to test the capacity of the testator, the first notary said, turning towards him, "When an individual makes his will, it is generally in favour or in prejudice of some person?" "Yes." "Have you an exact idea of the amount of your fortune?" "Yes." "I will name to you several sums which will increase by graduation. You will stop me when I reach the one representing the amount of your own possessions?" "Yes." There was a kind of solemnity in this interrogation. Never had the struggle between mind and matter been more apparent than now, and if it was not a sublime, it was at least a curious spectacle. They had formed a circle round the invalid. The second notary was sitting at a table, prepared for writing, and his colleague was standing before the testator in the act of interrogating him on the subject to which we have alluded. "Your fortune exceeds 300,000 francs, does it not?" asked he. Noirtier made a sign that it did. "Do you possess 400,000 francs? Inquired the notary. Noirtier's eyes remained immovable. 500,000. The same expression continued. 600,000. 700,000. 800,000. 900,000. Noirtier stopped him at the last named sum. "You are then in possession of 900,000 francs? Asked the notary. "Yes." "In landed property?" "No." "In stock?" "Yes." "The stock is in your own hands?" The look which Monsieur Noirtier cast on Barois showed that there was something wanted which he knew where to find. The old servant left the room, and presently returned, bringing with him a small casket. "Do you permit us to open this casket?" asked the notary. Noirtier gave his assent. They opened it and found 900,000 francs in bank scrip. The first notary handed over each note as he examined it to his colleague. The total amount was found to be as Monsieur Noirtier had stated. "It is all as he has said. It is very evident that the mind still retains its full force and vigour." Then, turning towards the paralytic, he said, "You possess, then, 900,000 francs of capital, which, according to the manner in which you have invested it, ought to bring in an income of about 40,000 livres? "Yes." "To whom do you desire to leave this fortune?" "Oh," said Madame de Villefort, "there is not much doubt on that subject. Monsieur Noirtier tenderly loves his granddaughter, Mademoiselle de Villefort. It is she who has nursed and tended him for 6 years, and has, by her devoted attention, fully secured the affection, I had almost said the gratitude, of her grandfather. And it is but just that she should reap the fruit of her devotion." The eye of Noirtier clearly showed by its expression that he was not deceived by the false assent given by Madame de Villefort's words and manner to the motives which she supposed him to entertain. "Is it, then, to Mademoiselle Valentine de Villefort that you leave these 900,000 francs? Demanded the notary, thinking he had only to insert this clause, but waiting first for the assent of Noirtier, which it was necessary should be given before all the witnesses of this singular scene. Valentine, when her name was made the subject of discussion, had stepped back to escape unpleasant observation. Her eyes were cast down, and she was crying. The old man looked at her for an instant with an expression of the deepest tenderness. Then, turning towards the notary, he significantly winked his eyes in token of dissent.
"What?" said the notary. "Do you not intend making Mademoiselle Valentine de Villefort your residuary legatee?"
"No."
"You are not making any mistake, are you?" said the notary. "You really mean to declare that such is not your intention?"
"No. No." Valentine raised her head. She was struck dumb with astonishment. It was not so much the conviction that she was disinherited which caused her grief, but her total inability to account for the feelings which had provoked her grandfather to such an act. But Noirtier looked at her with so much affectionate tenderness that she exclaimed,
"Oh, Grandpa, I see now that it is only your fortune of which you deprive me. You still leave me the love which I have always enjoyed."
"Ah, yes, most assuredly," said the eyes of the paralytic, for he closed them with an expression which Valentine could not mistake.
Thank you," murmured she.
The old man's declaration that Valentine was not the destined inheritor of his fortune had excited the hopes of Madame de Villefort. She gradually approached the invalid and said,
"Then, doubtless, dear Monsieur Noirtier, you intend leaving your fortune to your grandson, Edouard de Villefort?"
The winking of the eyes which answered this speech was most decided and terrible, and expressed a feeling almost amounting to hatred.
"No," said the notary. "Then perhaps it is to your son, Monsieur de Villefort?"
"No." The two notaries looked at each other in mute astonishment and inquiry as to what were the real intentions of the testator. Villefort and his wife both blushed and changed colour, one from shame, the other from anger.
"What have we all done, then, dear grandpapa?" said Valentine. "You no longer seem to love any of us."
The old man's eyes passed rapidly from Villefort and his wife, and rested on Valentine with a look of unutterable fondness.
"Well," said she, "if you love me, grandpapa, try and bring that love to bear upon your actions at this present moment. You know me well enough to be quite sure that I have never thought of your fortune. Besides, they say I am already rich in right of my mother, too rich even. Explain yourself, then."
Noirtier fixed his intelligent eyes on Valentine's hand.
"My hand?" said she.
"Yes."
"Her hand?" exclaimed everyone. "Oh, gentlemen, you see it is all useless, and that my father's mind is really impaired," said Villefort.
"Ah," cried Valentine suddenly, "I understand. It is my marriage, you mean, is it not, dear grandpapa?"
"Yes, yes, yes," sighed the paralytic, casting on Valentine a look of joyful gratitude for having guessed his meaning.
"You are angry with us all on account of this marriage, are you not?"
"Yes, really, this is too absurd," said Villefort.
"Excuse me, sir," replied the notary. "On the contrary, Monsieur Noirtier's meaning is quite evident to me, and I can quite easily connect the train of ideas passing in his mind." "You do not wish me to marry Monsieur France d'Epernay," observed Valentine.
"I do not wish it," said the eye of her grandfather. "And you disinherit your granddaughter," continued the notary, "because she has contracted an engagement contrary to your wishes."
"Yes."
"So that, but for this marriage, she would have been your heir?"
"Yes." There was a profound silence. The two notaries were holding a consultation as to the best means of proceeding with the affair. Valentine was looking at her grandfather with a smile of intense gratitude, and Villefort was biting his lips with vexation, whilst Madame de Villefort could not succeed in repressing an inward feeling of joy which, in spite of herself, appeared in her whole countenance.
"But," said Villefort, who was the first to break the silence,
I consider that I am the best judge of the propriety of the marriage in question. I am the only person possessing the right to dispose of my daughter's hand. It is my wish that she should marry Monsieur France d'Epernay, and she shall marry him." Valentine sank weeping into a chair. "Sir," said the notary, "how do you intend disposing of your fortune in case Mademoiselle de Villefort still determines on marrying Monsieur France?" The old man gave no answer. "You will, of course, dispose of it in some way or other." "Yes." "In favor of some member of your family?" "No." "Do you intend devoting it to charitable purposes, then?" pursued the notary. "Yes, but," said the notary, "you are aware that the law does not allow a son to be entirely deprived of his patrimony." "Yes." "You only intend, then, to dispose of that part of your fortune which the law allows you to subtract from the inheritance of your son?" Noirtier made no answer. "Do you still wish to dispose of all?" "Yes." "But they will contest the will after your death." "No." "My father knows me," replied Villefort. "He is quite sure that his wishes will be held sacred by me. Besides, he understands that in my position I cannot plead against the poor."
The eye of Noirtier beamed with triumph.
"What do you decide on, sir?" asked the notary of Villefort. "Nothing, sir. It is a resolution which my father has taken, and I know he never alters his mind. I am quite resigned. These 900,000 francs will go out of the family in order to enrich some hospital. But it is ridiculous thus to yield to the caprices of an old man, and I shall, therefore, act according to my conscience."
Having said this, Villefort quitted the room with his wife, leaving his father at liberty to do as he pleased. The same day, the will was made, the witnesses were brought, it was approved by the old man, sealed in the presence of all, and given in charge to Monsieur Deschamps, the family notary. 61. The Telegraph. Monsieur and Madame de Villefort found on their return that the Count of Monte Cristo, who had come to visit them in their absence, had been ushered into the drawing-room and was still awaiting them there. Madame de Villefort, who had not yet sufficiently recovered from her late emotion to allow of her entertaining visitors so immediately, retired to her bedroom, whilst the Procureur du Roi, who could better depend upon himself, proceeded at once to the drawing-room. Although Monsieur de Villefort flattered himself that, to all outward view, he had completely masked the feelings which were passing in his mind, he did not know that the cloud was still lowering on his brow, so much that the Count immediately remarked his sombre and thoughtful air. "Ma foi," said Monte Cristo, after the first compliments were over, "what is the matter with you, Monsieur de Villefort? Have I arrived at the moment that you were drawing up some case of capital indictment?" Villefort tried to smile. "No, Monsieur le Comte," replied Monsieur de Villefort. "I am the only victim in this case. It is I who lose my cause, and it is ill luck, obstinacy, and folly which have caused it to be decided against me." "To what do you allude?" said Monte Cristo, with well-feigned interest. "Have you really met with some great misfortune?" "Oh, Monsieur le Comte," said Villefort with a bitter smile, "it is only a loss of money which I have sustained. Nothing worth mentioning, I assure you." "True," said Monte Cristo. "The loss of a sum of money becomes almost immaterial with a fortune such as you possess, and a mind raised as yours is above the common events of life." "It is not so much the loss of the money which vexes me," said Villefort, "though, after all, 900,000 francs are worth regretting. But I am the more annoyed with this fate, chance, or whatever you please to call the power which has destroyed my hopes and my fortune, and may blast the prospects of my child also, as it is all occasioned by an old man relapsed into second childhood."
"What do you say?" said the Count. 900,000 francs?
It is indeed a sum which might be regretted even by a philosopher. And who is the cause of all this annoyance?
My father, as I told you.
Monsieur Noirtier? But I thought you told me he had become entirely paralyzed, and that all his faculties were completely destroyed.
Yes, his bodily faculties, for he can neither move nor speak. Nevertheless, he thinks, acts, and wills in the manner I have described. I left him about 5 minutes ago, and he is now occupied in dictating his will to two notaries.
But to do this, he must have spoken.
He has done better than that. He has made himself understood. How was such a thing possible? By the help of his eyes, which are still full of life, and, as you perceive, possess the power of inflicting mortal injury.
My dear, said Madame de Villefort, who had just entered the room, perhaps you exaggerate the evil. Good morning, madame, said the count, bowing. Madame de Villefort acknowledged the salutation with one of her most gracious smiles. "What is this that Monsieur de Villefort has been telling me?" demanded Monte Cristo. "And what incomprehensible misfortune—"
"Incomprehensible is not the word," interrupted the Procureur du Roi, shrugging his shoulders. "It is an old man's caprice."
"And is there no means of making him revoke the decision?"
"Yes," said Madame de Villefort, "and it is still entirely in the power of my husband to cause the will, which is now in prejudice of Valentine, to be altered in her favour."
The count, who perceived that Monsieur and Madame de Villefort were beginning to speak in parables, appeared to pay no attention to the conversation, and feigned to be busily engaged in watching Edouard, who was mischievously pouring some ink into the bird's water glass.
"My dear," said Villefort, in answer to his wife, "you know I have never been accustomed to play the patriarch in my family, nor have I ever considered that the fate of a universe was to be decided by my nod. Nevertheless, it is necessary that my will should be respected in my family, and that the folly of an old man and the caprice of a child should not be allowed to overturn a project which I have entertained for so many years. The Baron d'Epernay was my friend, as you know, and an alliance with his son is the most suitable thing that could possibly be arranged."
"Do you think," said Madame de Villefort, "that Valentine is in league with him? She has always been opposed to this marriage, and I should not be at all surprised if what we have just seen and heard is nothing but the execution of a plan concerted between them."
"Madame," said Villefort, "believe me, a fortune of 900,000 francs is not so easily renounced."
"She could, nevertheless, make up her mind to renounce the world, sir, since it is only about a year ago that she herself proposed entering a convent."
"Never mind," replied Villefort. "I say that this marriage shall be consummated."
"Notwithstanding your father's wishes to the contrary," said Madame de Villefort, selecting a new point of attack,
"that is a serious thing."
Monte Cristo, who pretended not to be listening, heard, however, every word that was said.
"Madame," replied Villefort, "I can truly say that I have always entertained a high respect for my father, because to the natural feeling of relationship was added the consciousness of his moral superiority. The name of father is sacred in two senses. He should be reverenced as the author of our being, and as a master whom we ought to obey. But, under the present circumstances, I am justified in doubting the wisdom of an old man who, because he hated the father, vents his anger on the son. It would be ridiculous in me to regulate my conduct by such caprices. I shall still continue to preserve the same respect towards Monsieur Noirtier. I will suffer without complaint the pecuniary deprivation to which he has subjected me, but I will remain firm in my determination, and the world shall see which party has reason on his side. Consequently, I shall marry my daughter to the Baron France d'Epernay, because I consider it would be a proper and eligible match for her to make, and, in short, because I choose to bestow my daughter's hand on whomsoever I please."
"What?" said the Count, the approbation of whose eye Vifor had frequently solicited during this speech.
What? Do you say that Monsieur Noirtier disinherits Mademoiselle de Vifor because she is going to marry Monsieur le Baron France d'Epernay?
Yes, sir. That is the reason, said Vifor, shrugging his shoulders.
The apparent reason, at least, said Madame de Vifor.
The real reason, madame, I can assure you. I know my father.
But I want to know in what way Monsieur d'Epernay can have displeased your father more than any other person.
I believe I know Monsieur France d'Epernay, said the Count.
Is he not the son of General de Quesnel, who was created Baron d'Epernay by Charles X?
The same, said Vifor.
Well, but he is a charming young man, according to my ideas.
He is, which makes me believe that it is only an excuse of Monsieur Noirtier's to prevent his granddaughter marrying. Old men are always so selfish in their affection, said Madame de Vifor.
But, said Monte Cristo, do you not know any cause for this hatred?
Ah, ma foi, who is to know?
Perhaps it is some political difference. My father and the Baron d'Epernay lived in those stormy times of which I have only seen the few last days, said de Vifor.
Was not your father a Bonapartist? Asked Monte Cristo.
I think I remember that you told me something of that kind.
My father has been a Jacobin more than anything else, said Vifor, carried by his emotion beyond the bounds of prudence. And the senator's robe which Napoleon cast on his shoulders only served to disguise the old man without any degree changing him. When my father conspired, it was not for the emperor, it was against the Bourbons. For Monsieur Noirtier possessed this peculiarity. He never projected any utopian schemes which could never be realized, but strove for possibilities, and he applied to the realization of these possibilities the terrible theories of Montaigne, who never shrank from any means which he deemed necessary to their accomplishment.
Well, said Monte Cristo, it is just as I thought. It was politics which brought Noirtier and Monsieur d'Epernay into personal contact. Although General d'Epernay served under Napoleon, did he not still retain royalist sentiments? And was he not the person who was assassinated one evening on leaving a Bonapartist meeting to which he had been invited on the supposition of his favouring the cause of the Emperor?
Vifor looked at the Count almost with terror.
Am I mistaken, then? Said Monte Cristo.
No, sir. The facts were precisely what you have stated, said Madame de Vifor, and it was to prevent the renewal of old feuds that Monsieur de Vifor formed the idea of uniting in the bonds of affection the two children of these inveterate enemies.
It was a sublime and charitable thought, said Monte Cristo, and the whole world should applaud it. It would be noble to see Mademoiselle Noirtier de Vifor assuming the title of Madame France d'Epernay.
Vifor shuddered and looked at Monte Cristo as if he wished to read in his countenance the real feelings which had dictated the words he had just pronounced. But the Count completely baffled the penetration of the Procureur du Roi and prevented him from discovering anything beneath the never-varying smile he was so constantly in the habit of assuming.
Although, said Vifor, it will be a serious thing for Valentine to lose the fortune of her grandfather, I do not think the marriage will be prevented on that account, nor do I believe that Monsieur d'Epernay will be frightened at this pecuniary loss. He will perhaps hold me in greater esteem than the money itself, seeing that I sacrifice everything in order to keep my word with him. Besides, he knows that Valentine is rich in right of her mother, and that she will, in all probability, inherit the fortune of Monsieur and Madame de Saint-Marin, her mother's parents, who both love her tenderly.
And who are fully as well worth loving and tending as Monsieur de Noirtier, said Madame de Vifor. Besides, they are to come to Paris in about a month, and Valentine, after the affront she has received, need not consider it necessary to continue to bury herself alive by being shut up with Monsieur Noirtier.
The Count listened with satisfaction to this tale of wounded self-love and defeated ambition.
"But it seems to me," said Monte Cristo, "and I must begin by asking your pardon for what I am about to say, that if Monsieur Noirtier disinherits Mademoiselle de Villefort on account of her marrying a man whose father he detested, he cannot have the same cause of complaint against this dear Edouard."
"True," said Madame de Villefort, with an intonation of voice which it is impossible to describe.
"Is it not unjust? Shamefully unjust. Poor Edouard is as much Monsieur Noirtier's grandchild as Valentine, and yet, if she had not been going to marry Monsieur France, Monsieur Noirtier would have left her all his money. And supposing Valentine to be disinherited by her grandfather, she will still be three times richer than he."
The Count listened and said no more.
"Monsieur le Comte," said Villefort, "we will not entertain you any longer with our family misfortunes. It is true that my patrimony will now go to endow charitable institutions, and my father will have deprived me of my lawful inheritance without any reason for doing so. But I shall have the satisfaction of knowing that I have acted like a man of sense and feeling. Monsieur d'Epernay, to whom I had promised the interest of this sum, shall receive it, even if I endure the most cruel privations."
"However," said Madame de Villefort, returning to the one idea which incessantly occupied her mind, "perhaps it would be better to represent this unlucky affair to Monsieur d'Epernay, in order to give him the opportunity of himself renouncing his claim to the hand of Mademoiselle de Villefort."
"Ah, that would be a great pity," said Villefort.
"A great pity?" said Monte Cristo.
"Undoubtedly," said Villefort, moderating the tones of his voice. "A marriage, once concerted and then broken off, throws a sort of discredit on a young lady. Then again, the old reports which I was so anxious to put an end to will instantly gain ground. No, it will all go well. Monsieur d'Epernay, if he is an honorable man, will consider himself more than ever pledged to Mademoiselle de Villefort, unless he were actuated by a decided feeling of avarice. But that is impossible."
"I agree with Monsieur de Villefort," said Monte Cristo, fixing his eyes on Madame de Villefort. "And if I were sufficiently intimate with him to allow of giving my advice, I would persuade him, since I have been told Monsieur d'Epernay is coming back, to settle this affair at once, beyond all possibility of revocation. I will answer for the success of a project which will reflect so much honor on Monsieur de Villefort." The Procureur du Roi rose, delighted with the proposition, but his wife slightly changed color.
"Well, that is all that I wanted, and I will be guided by a counselor such as you are," said he, extending his hand to Monte Cristo. "Therefore, let everyone here look upon what has passed today as if it had not happened, and as though we had never thought of such a thing as a change in our original plans."
"Sir," said the Count, "the world, unjust as it is, will be pleased with your resolution. Your friends will be proud of you, and Monsieur d'Epernay, even if he took Mademoiselle de Villefort without any dowry, which he will not do, would be delighted with the idea of entering a family which could make such sacrifices in order to keep a promise and fulfill a duty." At the conclusion of these words, the Count rose to depart.
"Are you going to leave us, Monsieur le Comte?" said Madame de Villefort.
"I am sorry to say I must do so, Madame. I only came to remind you of your promise for Saturday."
"Did you fear that we should forget it?"
"You are very good, madame. But Monsieur de Villefort has so many important and urgent occupations."
"My husband has given his word, sir," said Madame de Villefort. "You have just seen him resolve to keep it when he has all to lose, and surely there is more reason for his doing so when he has all to gain."
"And," said Villefort, "is it at your house in the Champs-Élysées that you receive your visitors?"
"No," said Monte Cristo, "which is precisely the reason which renders your kindness more meritorious. It is in the country."
"In the country?"
"Yes."
"Where is it, then?"
Near Paris, is it not?
Very near. Only half a league from the barriers. It is at Auteuil.
At Auteuil, said Villefort.
True. Madame de Villefort told me you lived at Auteuil, since it was to your house that she was taken. And in what part of Auteuil do you reside?
Rue de la Fontaine.
Rue de la Fontaine, exclaimed Villefort in an agitated tone. At what number?
Number 28.
Then, cried Villefort, was it you who bought Monsieur de Saint-Marin's house?
Did it belong to Monsieur de Saint-Marin? Demanded Monte Cristo.
Yes, replied Madame de Villefort. And would you believe it, Monsieur le Comte?
Believe what?
You think this house pretty, do you not?
I think it charming.
Well, my husband would never live in it.
Indeed, returned Monte Cristo. That is a prejudice on your part, Monsieur de Villefort, for which I am quite at a loss to account.
I do not like Auteuil, sir, said the Procureur du Roi, making an evident effort to appear calm.
But I hope you will not carry your antipathy so far as to deprive me of the pleasure of your company, sir, said Monte Cristo.
No, Monsieur le Comte, I assure you I will do all I can, stammered Villefort.
Oh, said Monte Cristo, I allow of no excuse. On Saturday at 6 o'clock I shall be expecting you, and if you fail to come I shall think, for how do I know to the contrary, that this house which has remained uninhabited for 20 years must have some gloomy tradition or dreadful legend connected with it.
I will come, Monsieur le Comte, I will be sure to come, said Villefort eagerly.
Thank you, said Monte Cristo. Now you must permit me to take my leave of you.
You said before you were obliged to leave us, Monsieur le Comte, said Madame de Villefort, and you were about to tell us the nature of the engagement which was to deprive us of the pleasure of your society when your attention was called to some other subject.
Indeed, Madame, said Monte Cristo, I scarcely know if I dare tell you where I am going.
Bah! Well, then, it is to see a thing on which I have sometimes mused for hours together.
What is it?
A telegraph.
So now I have told my secret.
What telegraph do you intend visiting? That of the Home Department or of the Observatory?
Oh, no, I should find there people who would force me to understand things of which I would prefer to remain ignorant, and who would try to explain to me, in spite of myself, a mystery which even they do not understand. I shall therefore not visit either of these telegraphs, but one in the open country, where I shall find a good-natured simpleton who knows no more than the machine he is employed to work.
You are a singular man, said Villefort. What line would you advise me to study?
That which is most in use just at this time.
The Spanish one, you mean, I suppose.
Which is the nearest way?
Bayonne?
Yes. The road to Bayonne.
And afterwards the road to Châtillon?
Yes.
By the Tower of Montlhéry, you mean?
Yes.
Thank you. Goodbye. On Saturday I will tell you my impressions concerning the telegraph.
At the door the Count was met by the two notaries, who had just completed the act which was to disinherit Valentine, and who were leaving under the conviction of having done a thing which could not fail of redounding considerably to their credit. 62. The Bribe. Not on the same night he had intended, but the next morning, the Count of Monte Cristo went out by the Barrière d'Enfer, taking the road to Orléans. Leaving the village of Linas, without stopping at the telegraph which, at the moment the Count passed, threw out its long bony arms, he reached the Tower of Montlhéry, situated, as everyone knows, upon the highest point of the plain of that name. At the foot of the hill the Count dismounted and began to ascend the mountain by a little winding path about 18 inches wide. When he reached the summit, he found himself stopped by a hedge upon which green fruit had succeeded to red and white flowers. Monte Cristo looked for the door of the enclosure and was not long in finding it. It was a little wooden gate working on willow hinges and fastened with a nail and string. The Count soon understood its mechanism, and the door opened. He then found himself in a little garden about 20 feet long by 12 wide, bounded on one side by part of the hedge, in which was formed the ingenious machine we have named a door, and on the other by the old tower, covered with ivy and studded with wild flowers. No one would have thought to have seen it thus wrinkled and yet adorned, like an old lady whose grandchildren come to greet her on her birthday, that it could have related some terrible scenes, if it could have added a voice to the menacing ears which an old proverb awards to walls. The garden was crossed by a path of red gravel, edged by a border of thick box of many years' growth, and of a tone and colour that would have delighted the heart of Delacroix, our modern Rubens. This path was formed in the shape of the figure 8, thus in its windings making a walk of 60 feet in a garden of only 20. Never had Flora, the fresh and smiling goddess of gardeners, been honoured with a purer or more minute worship than that which was paid to her in this little enclosure. In fact, of the 20 rose trees which formed the parterre, not one bore the mark of the fly, nor were there to be seen any of those clusters of green insects which destroy plants growing in a damp soil. And yet it was not because the damp had been excluded from the garden. The earth, black as soot, the thick foliage of the trees, told it was there. Besides, had natural humidity been wanting, it could have been immediately supplied by artificial means, thanks to a tank of water sunk in one of the corners of the garden, and upon which were stationed a frog and a toad, who, from antipathy, no doubt, always remained on the two opposite sides of the basin. There was not a blade of grass to be seen in the paths, nor a weed in the flower beds. No fine lady ever trained and watered her geraniums, her cactus, and rhododendrons with more pains than this hitherto unseen gardener bestowed upon his little enclosure. Monte Cristo stopped, after having closed the door and fastened the string to the nail, and cast a look around. "The man at the telegraph," said he, "must either engage a gardener or devote himself passionately to agriculture." Suddenly he struck himself against something crouching behind a wheelbarrow filled with leaves. The something rose, uttering an exclamation of astonishment, and Monte Cristo found himself facing a man about 50 years old, who was plucking strawberries, which he was placing upon vine leaves. He had 12 leaves and about as many strawberries, which, on rising suddenly, he let fall from his hand. "You are gathering your crop, sir?" said Monte Cristo, smiling. "Excuse me, sir," replied the man, raising his hand to his cap. "I am not up there, I know, but I have only just come down." "Do not let me interfere with you in anything, my friend," said the Count. "Gather your strawberries, if, indeed, there are any left." "I have 10 left, said the man, "for here are 11, and I had 21, 5 more than last year. But I am not surprised. The spring has been warm this year, and strawberries require heat, sir. This is the reason that instead of the 16 I had last year, I have this year, you see, 11 already plucked. 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, I missed 3. They were here last night, sir. I am sure they were here. I counted them. It must be the son of Mayor Simon who has stolen them. I saw him strolling about here this morning. Ah, the young rascal, stealing in a garden. He does not know where that may lead him to." "Certainly it is wrong," said Monte Cristo. "But you should take into consideration the youth and greediness of the delinquent." "Of course," said the gardener, "but that does not make it the less unpleasant. But, sir, once more I beg pardon. Perhaps you are an officer that I am detaining here?" And he glanced timidly at the Count's blue coat. "Calm yourself, my friend," said the Count, with that smile which at his will became so terrible or benevolent, and which this time beamed only with the latter expression. "I am not an inspector, but a traveller, conducted here by a curiosity he half repents of, since he causes you to lose your time." "Ah, my time is not valuable," replied the man with a melancholy smile. "Still, it belongs to government, and I ought not to waste it.
but having received the signal that I might rest for an hour, here he glanced at the sundial, for there was everything in the enclosure of Montlhéry, even a sundial, and having 10 minutes before me and my strawberries being ripe, when a day longer... By the by, sir, do you think dormice eat them?
Indeed, I should think not, replied Monte Cristo. Dormice are bad neighbours for us who do not eat them preserved, as the Romans did.
What? Did the Romans eat them?